I live in Georgia, the state that has the worst maternal death rate in the United States. Outcomes here are so terrible that we rank below nearly 100 other countries, including several war-torn regions. Abuse during birth is normalized and accepted and expected. When I was pregnant, I chose my care team diligently, educated myself, and engaged in birth preparation like I was preparing for a war. Because in a world where women die of medical neglect, both of over and under treatment, birth is a battle zone. I felt confident in my choices and in my team of doctors and midwives, and I felt good going into my birth. When I was 37 weeks pregnant with my first child, the hospital at which I had planned to give birth pulled the rug out from under me and made a stunning announcement. It would no longer be offering water birth. Oh, but it was so much worse than that. It would also be forcing some groups of women to have medically unnecessary C-sections that their doctors did not want to perform. It would force certain interventions, regardless of their medical necessity. It was clear that there was a cultural shift toward controlling and terrorizing women. Women have a right to say no, even when they are giving birth. These policy changes were illegal on their face and clearly designed to control and dominate women. I panicked. I didn't know what to do, and I had only 3 weeks. I reached out to local feminist organizations, but none of them were interested in helping. It was my first real introduction to anti-mother misogyny, to how little we care about what happens to women during birth. I finally realized that if no one was stepping up, I had to. So I gave up sleep. I rallied the women I knew. I wrote press releases, reached out to national birth justice organizations, and got in touch with a team of lawyers. Within a day, I had a group of nearly 3,000 women who were ready to protest at the hospital all day, every day until the policies changed. They wrote letters. There were dozens of media stories. My husband, a lawyer, contacted the hospital detailing the lawsuit he intended to file on my behalf. The hospital lawyer quickly got back to us and let us know that they would not impose these policies on me, that of course they would be happy to make an exception for me. They clearly viewed me as a threat and hoped to defuse me. But to quote Audre Lorde, I am not free while any woman is unfree. I thanked the lawyer for his written commitment to honoring the law, then shared his behavior publicly and continued with my protest efforts. The backlash was swift. I began receiving death threats, as did many other women. The hate lobbed in my direction told me I was a threat. I embraced it rather than shrinking away. The hospital PR team tried to depict us as hormonal, irrational women. So I told them that we, being irrational and all, would line the street in front of the hospital during rush hour traffic, hundreds of us carrying signs and megaphones until they abandoned their war against us. They then tried to pretend we were crazy natural birthers ignoring good science in spite of the fact that we had our doctor's support. So I told them that we'd stand at every hospital entrance during our protest, ensuring everyone who entered or exited the hospital knew the danger and abuse they faced. The hospital lawyer, who had no medical training and apparently no brain, made the mistake of inserting his own opinions. So I told him I'd send my pregnant protesters down to his law firm along with the media, and that if they tried to do anything about it, the images of them arresting peaceful pregnant women asserting their basic human rights would end up on the news for days. The hospital's leadership team finally agreed to meet with me, so I took along a handful of other pregnant friends and advocates. I wanted a group that represented the diverse range of attitudes toward and experiences of birth. Multiple C-section mothers, women choosing epidurals, and women like me who were choosing unmedicated births. By the time we arrived in their office, their fear of us was palpable. We scared them. They didn't know what to do because they had never been pushed on so hard, so publicly, for so long. At one point, the hospital lawyer asked us if we could teach him how to write emails without misogyny. They finally acceded to our demands, not because of their own goodness, but because we had the law and justice on our side, and because we made clear that we would rain down consequences on them and make them miserable until they stopped. Patriarchy does not respond to niceness. It does not give in to logical arguments or well-articulated moral claims because patriarchy has never been about logic or morality. It is about control. Patriarchy expects us to roll over. But women are the majority, and mothers are the majority of women. We are the ones who make and sustain life. We are the ones who decide whether the species continues. And when we refuse to roll over for patriarchy, patriarchy has to roll over for us instead. There is power in motherhood if we ignore our conditioning, ignore the messaging of patriarchy, and tap into our maternal rage. That rage connects us with other women. If we build solidarity with them, including women we don't like, including women who are different from us, we become unstoppable. Motherhood can be a source of power. Birth, however we give birth, as long as we are safe and supported, can be a transformative experience from which we derive significant purpose. It can be a catalyst that empowers us to break the shackles of patriarchy. After all, patriarchy is all about controlling birth because misogynist men fear its power. Hi, I'm Zahn Valliens, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. As always, I'd like to ask you to help support this podcast by sharing it on social media, by leaving a positive review on your favorite podcast platform, by heart reacting it on Substack, and by leaving comments or otherwise engaging. As many of you know, social media algorithms are trying to drive away feminist and leftist creators. The most effective way to push back is to give the algorithm what it wants, which is engagement. You can also sign up to become a paid subscriber and get at least one bonus podcast episode a month. These actions to promote the podcast really do help, as subscribers are the sole reason that I'm able to do this work, and your support and promotion helps me keep doing it. I will never accept advertiser money or allow this work to be censored, so I am dependent solely on you, my listeners. Thanks for being here. Today's opening vignette is a little bit different because it is my story. I wanted to share it because, in many ways, it is my origin story. But I received so many stories for this podcast, and I want to share some of them so that folks can understand how truly dire things are in birth culture. So I'll be posting some of them in the show notes. My guest today is someone I first met through that protest, who stood beside me and supported me and taught me, and who has been a beloved friend ever since. I'm here today with Kristen Pascucci of Birth Monopoly. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, Zahn. It's great to hear your voice.
I am so glad to have you here. Let me tell you guys about Kristen. Kristen is the founder of Birth Monopoly, and she has worked tirelessly to protect and help pregnant people for more than a decade. She's masterminded numerous activist campaigns, including mine, supported lawsuits, and worked with organizations such as Improving Birth. She teaches activists, parents, and experts about birthing justice, birth rights, and self-advocacy in birth. She's contributed in some way to almost any improvement in our maternity care system that has occurred over the last decade that you might think of. And I just love her so much. I really do, Kristen.
Oh my
Uh-oh.
God, that was so sweet. Thanks. It's nice to hear other people say nice things about me.
Well, I know that a lot of people say mean things about you because the more you push on patriarchy, the more it pushes back.
Yeah, when you said you got death threats for your efforts at the, against the hospital there, I was like, oh man, I remember those days. I don't get those anymore, but I do have bad memories.
Yeah, it's so dark. It's just so dark. So before we get started, I want to add that Jeff and I did a podcast about a year ago about the state of childbirth and a patriarchy, why patriarchy wants to control birth, how it does it, and just how bad things are here in the US, where birth is getting progressively more dangerous, not less. So if you're not
Yeah.
familiar with these issues, I recommend starting there because that's where we get into like the statistics and we share a lot of people's experiences. Kristen is here to share some additional science, but also as a witness and as a sort of friendly big sister to give advice on self-advocacy in this awful abusive system.
Thanks.
So, okay, Kristen, I'm so excited to finally be interviewing you about this. I
Yay.
think it would be good to get your introduction to this issue. Tell listeners what's going wrong with birth and how is that related to patriarchy? How does it uphold the patriarchy? Like, what is happening?
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a huge question. I mean, I think your introduction did a really great job explaining that. So you're talking about something that happened, to you as an individual, and then to like a group of community members that came down from the policy level at the hospital. Those things, it just replicates throughout the larger system, that kind of stuff. The same thing that happened to you, the same kinds of like super restrictive policies happen all over the country, fairly arbitrarily. And like you said, there isn't a lot of like logic or morals happening there. But because women, are up against this, I guess, archetype of like hysterical, emotional beings who aren't capable of making really important decisions. The conversation has really never been equal. So all that misogyny is, it just like permeates at every level, like from individual, I think, like interpersonal interactions when you're pregnant with, the family members and members of the general public. And then it like, it goes up through all the layers of the system, all the way up to, when we're talking about like the justice system and policy that comes down from the federal level. It all just kind of, it tends to replicate those paternalistic leanings.
It's total paternalism. And so, like, I have this theory that pregnancy and birth and early postpartum are kind of this process of getting women to accept the like devalued identity of motherhood. So then they will really just feel alone and accept all of the labor society foists upon them. But that doesn't seem to be how a lot of people feel, because what I hear from a lot of people is, well, the baby's alive, that's all that matters. And well, it's just one bad day. And people often try to pretend that this is just about like unmedicated birth and like crunchy mothers. But I see this on people, I see this among people on the other side of things too. Like, I had a friend who had a really significant trauma history and who didn't feel safe giving birth vaginally. And so she wanted an elective C-section, which is like a completely reasonable thing to want. It's medically necessary for her. And the system pushed just as hard on her about that. And then finally it granted the C-section. It did everything it could to make that C-section traumatic for her. So, like, when we talk about birth justice, we're talking about the fact that we don't honor any woman's choices, autonomy, or safety across the
No,
spectrum.
it's like it's seen as a punishment.
Yes.
It's like the process of birth is seen as a punishment. And I don't know if that goes back to, the literal genesis of Christianity that we're all taught that, it's a curse, that like childbirth is a curse. And it's almost like this, it's like the retribution on you for being born a woman or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wonder how deep that programming goes, because I think a lot of us, especially in red states, which, you're in Georgia, I'm in Kentucky. Those stories, those start, they start really young, and so I think, in some ways we're almost like primed as women.
Yeah, we
You know what I
totally
mean?
are.
So like, yeah,
Well, and
like it's like your punishment.
we're also
Childbirth is
taught
the
that, like,
punishment for being a woman.
yes. Well, and we're also taught that, like, the rational way to be about birth is to not have any specific feelings about it. Like, I have a number of women who, like, take great pride in being like, well, my birth plan is to get a healthy baby. And I'm like, but is it really, shouldn't it also include not having, like, lifelong bladder dysfunction and not having trauma? Like, don't you think that you deserve that? But I think that, we kind of know that it's not really safe to give birth in this system, so we just fall
Well,
back on this thing.
and like, I mean, speaking of safety, there's some psychological safety. There's a level of psychological safety in like releasing your expectations, in not saying I'm going to put my hopes and dreams into this being, an empowering, non-traumatic, super supported, life-changing experience. Like, it's scary. To like to want birth to be that good, to want it to be something that we imagine that it could be and that, few of us actually experience. I think there is some psychological safety in thinking, just letting go of all of that and being like, I just want to live. I just want to survive. I'm just going to focus on the baby. I'm going to, almost like disassociate my experience from the experience, even though like you literally are the center of the experience. I don't know. Like, I know that there have been times in my life when I have, that has felt easier and safer and more comfortable to be like, you know what? I just have to get through it.
Yeah.
And whatever happens, I'm just going to live through it. And that's all that matters. And of course, it's a little bit of a, it's like, it's a false, sense of comfort and security and safety because we're still traumatized, whether or not we're, fully present in the experience or we have dissociated from the experience. You still get hit with that trauma. It might just, be something that's more protracted and more, more under the surface, which really makes it harder to address later. And I think that, a lot of women believe that they don't have expectations about the experience. But you're still vulnerable. You can still be traumatized. And, I will say, I've talked to so many women when we're talking about this, like, oh, it's just a natural birth thing. I've talked to so many women who they weren't abused trying to have a natural birth. They were abused with the plan of going along with the, going with the flow.
Yeah.
They were like, I went in trusting my doctor and they fucked me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I
Like,
think that's often when people do get hurt the most. And I think that it's just like the classic victim blaming narrative of like, well, these women with their bizarre ideas about birth, of course they're going to have bad births. But,
yeah.
most women aren't like me going into birth with like a lawyer and like a very specific list of demands.
Yes,
And
true.
yet most women leave birth with some degree of trauma. And so it's not, that you're wanting the wrong things. It's being a woman in the system.
Yeah, and also, speaking of what it is that we all want, the research is like pretty consistent that the majority of women don't have super specific asks. They're not going, I don't want this procedure. I do want this procedure. I don't want this. I do want that. Most women have the idea that birth is first and foremost a physiologic event that might need medical intervention and not the other way around. So most women already think that way, which I think is like a very reasonable starting point, like a very rational and logical starting point that yes, like we are mammals who give birth. We're gonna give birth whether or not there is medical intervention. However, medical intervention can make it better at times, can make it more safe, can save lives. And then, as we all know, if you over intervene, you can make it more dangerous. So, like, it's actually like a super evidence-based perspective to say, first and foremost, I see it as a psychological, or I'm sorry, psych, well, it is psychological, but a physiologic event. And then, yes, sometimes it needs medical intervention too. That is already the perspective of most women.
Yeah. Well, and
And
context
those are the
matters.
women who are still getting abused and traumatized.
Exactly. So like context
Sorry, what
matters
did
a
you say?
lot. Context matters here, 'cause with our youngest child, I mean, I'm a natural birther through and through. Like that's my personality. Like that's what I want. Women are allowed to want things no matter what like patriarchy tells us. But with our youngest child, we like I had the unmedicated birth without an epidural. So in that regard, I got what I wanted. But we had a number of complications. So I ended up after 4 days in labor having to get some Pitocin. And my team was like really supportive and helpful. We did a low dose. They unplugged me when I no longer needed it. Like I could move around. And then she was born with some respiratory distress. So like I got to hold her for like a second and then she had to get intubated. But there again, like they brought her right to me. They didn't do any more than was necessary. And so it was still a good birth. But if that had been the birth of my first daughter, who did not need any of those things, it would have felt traumatic because then it would have been, well, they did all these things and they separated me from her for like no reason. So this is not about like wanting to avoid medical intervention. It's about like don't interfere with the mother's body, with the mother-baby bond. Like don't do to women things that are not necessary that they don't want. And like maybe we should start telling women that you are allowed to want things. Like there's this idea in patriarchy that like we're not allowed to want anything, whether it's a certain birth or like a Mother's Day present.
I know. It's I remember that being one of the like super, really frustrating things when I first started doing this work because I feel like I was coming at it from a pretty logical point of view. And then like I just kept hearing what you just said, like over and over, where like people couldn't get past the idea that I wasn't supposed to have an opinion in the first place. When I said, hey, the evidence shows this, or the options are that, or having any kind of a voice whatsoever, it was like, oh, no, that's actually a non-starter. We don't want to hear from you. If my doctor or midwife were to speak on my behalf, that would be seen as acceptable. But for me to say, I want this or I want that, it was like, oh, well, you're automatically suspect. Like you're not a credible witness right off the bat.
Well, and there's this framing of women as selfish, entitled, spoiled princesses, when actually they're the people who love their babies the most and who are most invested in their baby's well-being and who will have to live with whatever happens long after it's a distant memory for the birth team.
Well, I mean, and that's just actually wild to me that people say that someone could be selfish about giving birth. Like, giving birth in itself is like one of the least selfish things you can do. It's wild that anybody could try to diminish that, that act of sacrifice by saying you're selfish. Like it's like I'm saying I'm making this huge sacrifice and I'm making this sacrifice on my own terms, and people are like, how dare you?
Well, I think you're hitting on something there because I do think diminishing all of the really intensely meaningful aspects of birth is kind of the goal here. I mean, I think that a big part of the reason that we have patriarchy is because it seems to me that women are the ones who have the most natural power, given that we make people. And I think that's very scary to men. And I think that patriarchy has been the story of men trying to control and just trying to control our ability to make people. And I think we see that in the battlefield that is obstetrics.
I mean, for birthing women to exist in the patriarchy, you have to be a vessel. Like, that's the only way you fit into the picture. And so that is why I think there's all this pushback when a birthing person shows up as someone with agency.
Okay, so when Jeff and I did our podcast on birth about a year ago, we got more negative feedback on that than any other topic. And I didn't feel like we were making very controversial assertions. We were talking about how racism is a known fact in maternity care and sexism is a known fact. But most of the feedback that we got was from doctors and other clinicians who depicted themselves as like the real victims. They're being maligned and it's not fair and it's hurting them. And who denied the existence of racism and sexism in maternity care. This is like so alarming to me because the people who are creating and replicating a harmful system feel aggrieved and victimized. And because the research has proven these biases exist, and also that the more you deny the existence of your own bias, the more likely you are to weaponize those biases against your patients. I also like, I definitely think the way we treat women during birth essentially sets them up for all of the maltreatment motherhood entails, and that strong backlash we get when we start talking about that speaks to that. But like, what do you say to these skeptical doctors who are like, oh, we're just being bullied by the, natural birth warriors?
It's just, I'm trying to, how do I, how am I diplomatic about this? I guess it just seems like such a replication to me of like historical power dynamics that have, we've seen this throughout history. Guys, pick up a history book, figure out who you are in the, in the on the stage in the play that's happening, you can see what part you're playing, and then if you can have like a little bit of perspective on that, then you can see really clearly that you're the ones with almost all of the power. It's just kind of laughable to me that someone would, try to call themselves a victim, as the person with all the power. That's not to say that they can never be victimized, but it really is about perspective. I look at it as like, I'm a white woman, right? I am both victimized by the patriarchy, and I also get some benefits, as a matter of fact, especially in my proximity to non-white women. So I can be, and I'm sure I have been, an oppressor of Black women while also being severely abused by white men. Like, it's all about perspective. In fact, like before we even, I think, started recording, we actually had a little bit of a conversation about sort of like victimhood in general. It's an interesting, it's hard to get into because, it really takes self-awareness and inner work, I think, to be able to get to a place where you can even, you've got to be able to like beat through the cognitive dissonance that you're so kind of enmeshed in, to see yourself clearly and to be able to process, I have hurt people. It doesn't mean I'm a bad person. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't mean that you are an irredeemable villain. It means that all of us at some point hurt other people. Now, in this case, there's a really identifiable pattern to the hurt. And so I think it's really crucial for anybody to have self-awareness about like where they fit into the kind of like oppression matrix, yeah, I don't know. I mean, closing thought, it's kind of silly to me, that a healthcare provider would consider themselves to be a victim. Actually, you know what? Let me tweak that statement a little bit. I could see how on an individual level that could possibly be true. On a systemic level, absolutely not in any framework that you're looking at.
Yeah. I mean, like at a certain point, we have to just tell people, be serious. Like, if we want to talk about, oh, these crunchy moms are not listening to science, the people who are not listening to science are the people who are not listening to the overwhelming science showing that racism and misogyny, not to mention classism, ableism, every other ism, are rife in birth culture and that these have real effects. So, like, if you want to be a scientist, pay attention to that too.
Yeah. It makes me think of, I know this is going to sound, dramatic, but it reminds me of when one of the women I have worked with for years now, who was assaulted in birth, she said, "The hospital is my Brock Turner."
Yeah, wow.
And it was it's just like a story form of what you're talking about, where she was physically assaulted. She was first defrauded in the, in the first place to in going to the hospital because they had promised her certain services that did not manifest when she got there. And then she was physically assaulted, psychologically traumatized, had PTSD for the first time in her life, being a super healthy person physically and mentally prior to this birth. So she came out of it both psychologically traumatized and debilitated physically, because of primarily because of a nerve injury that she received at the hospital. And she ended up suing the hospital, and the whole trial, they portrayed themselves as kind of the victim in the situation. It was very just, they were just being the good guy this whole time, and they just did everything they could to save her baby. And it's too bad she's so ungrateful about it.
Yeah, it's too bad she just wanted her baby dead. Like we say that about women without saying that about women, and it's so
Oh, all the
false.
time. Yeah, it's super frustrating. I mean, it's like, speaking of perspective, like I'm risking my life to have this baby, and you're gonna tell me that I am willy-nilly making choices that would throw my baby's life away because I want a better experience. That happens over and over and over and over. I've seen so many apology letters or heard so many apologies, hospital or doctor to patient, where it's very, we're sorry that you didn't get the experience you wanted, but we had to keep your baby safe. Now, the unwritten part of that is from you,
Yeah,
right?
it's like,
Like
I'm
that's
sorry
what
you're a
they're,
bad mom.
yeah, I mean, that's what they're implying, that the mother is prioritizing. Gosh, back in the day, it was always she didn't get the, the scented candles she wanted and the, the low lighting, and that's why she's so mad. And it's, it's just a false narrative. I mean, you look at any of these stories, girl. Nobody's getting traumatized by not having the right candles in the room. You're getting traumatized because you're completely helpless at the mercy of strangers who have no consideration for your autonomy, for your psychological welfare, for the bonding, not interfering with the bonding or recklessly interfering with the bonding between you and your baby. Yeah, that's enormously traumatizing. And and a lot of times it's people who there's no consent is like not even in the room. It's not a discussion. It's you're told what's going to happen to you, and unfortunately that is largely determined just by where you happen to be when you give birth. What they happen to do at that hospital, not based on who you are as an individual and your actual medical, physical, emotional, psychological needs. So, it's like if you're put on this like assembly line, that might involve somebody cutting your perineum with a pair of scissors. Like, yeah, that's a little more than, not getting the candles you wanted.
Yeah, but it's all, we guilt mothers for everything because, again, we think mothers are not allowed to want things. And we also think that anything a woman actually needs to be okay is just a want. Like, women don't have needs and they're not allowed to have wants. We're just vessels. It's just enraging.
I mean, you see this in postpartum, and like, that's like it's enraging. Like, like the women who like, I see them on social media all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
Just
I
in
know what you're about to get into
throes.
because it's just.
Yeah. And like just the throes of postpartum. And they've got a partner who's complaining that they're being, woken up in the middle of the night from the baby crying. While this person is recovering from major surgery or recovering from a vaginal birth, which may or may not have involved, stitches or, some kind of operative delivery or, whatever. Not to mention, like, even if you had the least complicated natural birth in the whole world, you still need a lot of recovery time. Your
I mean,
body is literally healing a wound inside,
I was shocked by how, with my first, I mean, I had like a textbook natural birth. I mean, it was like a long labor and she was big, but I didn't get injured. Everybody took great care of me. I also have like a great partner who was truly doing his share. And I was shocked by like how vulnerable I felt in the recovery. And I remember thinking, I don't see how any woman in the world who does not have a good partner like survives this. I don't see it because it's so hard and so vulnerable.
I mean, I didn't have a partner, and postpartum was it was miserable. I also didn't have like a robust support system. You know what I mean? I had people who were like absolutely willing to help if I asked for help. And like that is it is like no knock on them. Like they did everything they thought they were supposed to do. You know what I mean? Like they were absolutely acting out of like the best motives and out of love and care and compassion and all of those things. However, it is just like this cultural thing that women are first expected to be responsible during postpartum, as opposed to like, oh, hey, you're terribly vulnerable during this time. And this is, it is like the job of family, neighbors, community support systems to come in and make sure that like you don't have to worry about anything. Like you shouldn't have to worry about laundry and dishes and, God forbid, taking care of a partner or other children who could be helped by someone else at that point. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's like, what does the village do instead of like stepping in and helping? It goes like this. Woman comes home from the hospital. She's probably got an injury statistically. She's statistically probably experienced some trauma and probably hasn't had a partner who's been there to help her during this huge rite of passage and has undermined it in some way. So she's already got a psychological and a physical wound. And then she's going to be sleep deprived while the lazy man next to her doesn't do anything. Then she's going to struggle with breastfeeding. There's going to be chores. There's maybe going to be other kids. She's going to be more exhausted than any human being could imagine. And then at some point, she'll post on like a mom group and be like, "So I had birth trauma and now I'm paying myself. And I had all this stuff happen to me during birth that I need to process that I can't. And my partner's not participating in the child that he helped make. And I'm not sleeping. What should I do?" And the first comment is always, "Have you been screened for postpartum depression?" Instead of like, "Have you been screened for having a shitty partner in a shitty system?" And I feel like as soon as she accepts, "Oh yeah, it must be my crazy woman hormones causing me to feel this way," it's like then the loop has been closed and she has finally accepted her denigrated, devalued role as a person who is not entitled to anything.
It always just ends with, well, this is just how it is.
And like it doesn't have to be.
No, and I'll tell you what, as hard as postpartum was, I would have been suicidal if I had to also take care of a partner during that time. Or not even take care of, just like watch that person not help or make more work for me. I don't think I could have like literally could have handled that. I'm not even joking when I say that. Like
I mean, the
I don't know
amount of
how.
like abuse I see from women with partners. When I did my survey of women's postpartum experiences, it was something like 80 or 90% of them who experienced some form of abuse from their partners in the immediate postpartum period, whether it was like forcing them to have sex, calling them names, hitting them. For a lot of them, the abuse started for the first time ever in the postpartum period. Truly horrific to see what we are doing to women. And also, like, truly a testament to how strong women are, that women endure this and then they just get up and live their lives.
But I mean, there's a cost, you know?
Yeah, there is a cost.
And I, you know, when you're describing those things, all I can think of is like, you sound like you're describing people who are property.
Yeah, and that's what we want women to be. Like, that's what this is. It's the complete dehumanization of women.
Yeah, so let me, okay, I'm gonna like talk about the other side of the coin just for a minute here. I'm gonna talk about rest and healing, as an antidote to this is just the way it is, which is being hurt, injured, traumatized, devalued, degraded, in all of these ways. To heal from trauma, like your brain literally needs rest. It can't heal when you're continuously in survival mode, which is what postpartum usually is like absolute survival mode for a really long time. The rest part, it's like the rest is necessary for the healing.
Yeah.
And the healing is necessary for the wholeness, you know, for, and it's not even getting back to, you know, there's really no such thing as going back to a normal. It's you have now become a different version of yourself post-birth, post-parenthood. You are a different version of yourself. There's no way that you can't expand, you know, in certain ways to meet that. And I think about like from the perspective of like energy and creativity, how I have watched those things wax and wane in my life, like in direct correlation to where I am like on my trauma scale, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
You know, there were so many years when I was so sleep deprived and literally traumatized. You know, like I had an amount of birth trauma, nothing like, you know, most of the women that I work with. But I did have an amount of birth trauma that really did not come around for me for like 10 years. Like it didn't even, you know, I said for years I did not have a traumatic birth. And I didn't really face that for like 10 years. And then, you know, had all these other, you know, pressures in my private life. And it wasn't until like those pressures released for various reasons that suddenly I found myself able to write or to draw or to paint or to embroider, to literally have like a part of my creative brain light up that had not lit up in years. And one of the really important, I think, like critical aspects of this is like the part of your imagination and your creativity that allow you to imagine a different future.
Yeah.
For the
Yeah.
years that I was like really stuck in like deep trauma, I could never imagine anything else. It was just, you're in this tunnel and you're gonna be in this tunnel. And that's it. Like there was no vision beyond that whatsoever. And so when we're talking about sort of like the longer term costs of all of these things, I look at it as like losing years of my life. You know, those were years that I was able to keep myself alive and keep my baby, my child alive. And I don't feel like I did much more than that. You know, it was, you know, survival mode is not living. It's being alive, but it's not living.
Well, so
And
I just want to point out I believe you and hear that that's the mode you were in. But you did a lot in survival mode. So I think, that's something I
I
always try
did,
to keep in
but
mind.
that's all I did.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, like, and it's funny you say this because I was just thinking about this the other day. I was thinking about the difference between my interior experience versus like my, what other people would see happening, right? So you might come over to my house and go, "Oh my gosh, this is so cute. I love how you've decorated. Things are neat and pretty and whatever." And wow, you're speaking at these different conferences around the country and the world, and you've put out all this material and you're whatever. But it took every bit of energy I had to make any of that happen. And I didn't enjoy any of it. It was just like my interior experience was, I have to get up again today. God damn it. Ugh, I don't want to. But I have to meet these markers. My house has to look a certain way because, somebody's stopping by. It's got to look like this. I didn't enjoy it. It wasn't like, oh, I love my home and I just like delight in existing in this beautiful environment. Hell no, not at all. It was just like, God, I got to keep up sort of keep up appearances in this way. But also from like a very realistic point of view, like not just keep up appearances, but like you can't neglect basics like, eating and, having clean dishes and having clean clothes and stuff like that. So like, I don't know, like from the outside, it might look like this person's functioning great. And wow, look at all this work she's doing. But like what was actually happening like behind closed doors was I didn't do anything else except just manage to like produce the work that other people saw. I wasn't like there was no like enjoyment of life. Like it sucked. I hated it.
Well, and that does suck for someone who's contributing so much to like not enjoy it. But the reason I raise that, well, I raise it for two
Well,
reasons.
hold on. Wait, let me say one more thing. Sorry, because
Go
I think
ahead.
this is important. I also think, and I totally did not pick up on this at the time. It was later that I realized I was driven by my trauma, like the trauma that I didn't acknowledge for 10 years. That was what was driving me. So if other people look at those things, whatever I did, if they see it as an accomplishment, it didn't feel like an accomplishment to me. It felt like I had to do it in order to survive, if that makes any sense, because I was actually being strongly driven by my own trauma. So that was, it was a very different experience to me than to like what someone might have looked at from the outside. Like there was no point where I was like appreciating the accolades and being like, yay. It was like, no, actually, I'm super depressed. The more I get into this work, the worse it is. Okay, sorry. I just had to say that.
No, it's I'm glad that you said that because so I kind of have I have like a counter experience and I often hesitate to talk about how birth affected me because so many people have had like really horrific births and my first birth was really a wonderful birth and I have a wonderful partner and like a network of women who helped me and so the effect of giving birth and then going through postpartum for me was like magical. It was like a process of stepping into my power and becoming a fundamentally different person who felt like a strong sense of solidarity with other women. Because after my birth, I didn't come away saying, oh, like I'm so special because I birthed that way or it's so different for me. I came away thinking, oh my God, look at what women do. And it has. It's driven me. And it made me much more aware of how many women are deprived of that experience and how depriving women of that experience is depriving them of really immense power. And that's not an accident. And it's not like something that we can just ignore. Birth can be an immense source of power and meaning, no matter how you give birth. And it should be because it's hard and because it's making life and because it's a rite of passage and you should be supported. And instead, we take this moment that should be a source of power and we turn it into a source of degradation. And I just will never believe that that's an accident.
Yeah, well, as you're saying that, I'm thinking of the parallels with sex. Something that, there is a strong parallel in, when it comes to like consensual experiences. If you go through sex that is not consensual is rape, right? It's an assault. And you can say the same thing about maternity care that is forced or non-consensual, that it is an assault. And many women will also say it feels like rape. And yes, I know how that sounds. And for many years, I wouldn't even say that publicly. But the reality is, I can't tell you the number of women who have like unprompted said, my birth felt like rape. I think that these things are they're actually so closely tied. Coming out of a rape is a soul killer. As someone who is a survivor myself and can speak to it, it like fundamentally alters, your sense of self. It changes the way you think about the future, about your identity, about what you're capable of, about how safe the world is, about whether you can trust people. I mean, it changes like it like alters your path in life in a lot of ways. I can't speak for everyone, but I think that's true for, most people. And but you can also say sex can be a literal sacred experience. It could be life-changing in the best way, right? It can be like this incredible, almost spiritual thing that opens like totally new doors in you. And I would say the same about birth. These are places where there are moments where transformation is possible and deep transformation in different directions. And so it's like even more reason to take so much care in that space, as support people and medical providers to like safeguard the psychological and emotional well-being of that person. I can't like I'm trying to think about like how to I don't know, it just seems so obvious to me, to like to think of, and I'm like, oh, how graphic do I get with this? But like, it just seems really obvious to me. Like, the difference between, healthy sex and rape could be someone saying, oh, are you okay? You look off. Are you sure? Is this what you want?
I mean, I think that's a great parallel, and it's actually one. I have also talked to so many women who say that their births are like rape and immediately intuitively understand why that is and what they mean. But this is the first time I've really thought about kind of the parallels between like essentially non-consensual birth practices and non-consensual sex. I think you're spot on.
Yeah.
I think
Well, and
that.
I also want to say, like I said a minute ago, I didn't say that publicly for a really long time because I felt like that sounds really extreme. It sounds really, like wacky. Like only someone who's like mentally unwell would make a statement like that, which was my own misogyny, honestly. Because the more I heard that statement, and the more I realized that, like, actually, this is coming from rape survivors who are saying this. They have experienced both of these things and they are comparing them. This isn't just like some like wacky feminist activist who's like making up shit, These are, again, unprompted, unsolicited comparisons by people who have experienced like both non-consensual maternity care and non-consensual sex. And they're saying they felt the same or similar.
Well, I also think that mentally unwell comment you made is so interesting because there's such a concerted effort to police what women activists say publicly. And we turn that policing on ourselves and are constantly
Oof,
afraid of misstepping. And often the way that we're afraid of misstepping is by being crazy and asserting that someone like cutting open your vagina is like rape is about the least crazy thing I can think of. But we all have these worries of appearing to be crazy because patriarchy wants us to just be quiet.
you know what? I'm gonna take this a step further, and I'm gonna say, just to really like fuck with people's minds. Think about this. There is also, ready?
I'm
There
ready.
is sexual assault that occurs in maternity care.
There's what's I think the statistic is something like 6 or 8%. It's pretty high.
Yeah. So, and here, like, we gotta like define some things, right? Whether we are talking about the perspective of the victim or the, we're going to call them perpetrator, is important, because I think you would have a much higher percentage of patients and women saying that felt like assault, like a sexual assault, than you would ever, ever, ever have of providers saying, I intended to commit a sexual assault. Like, I'm a predator. A sexual predator, and I prey on vulnerable women in the birth setting, right? Is an infinitesimal number compared to the providers who inadvertently who are committing acts who women interpret as sexual assault, all right? So stick with me here on this nuance. There are though There or there is that small number, which I don't know that number, and I haven't heard that 6 to 8%. I would love to see where you got that, and you know what they had to say about that. But yes, there are also people who like intentionally commit sexual assault in birth, and I've talked to many of their victims. And do you think that a woman can prove that she was sexually assaulted by an OBGYN or a nurse midwife or a nurse in obstetrics? It's almost impossible. It takes so much. It takes like, 1,000,000% evidence to prove something like that. The cases that you'll see, if you were to Google it's people who did it for 10, 15, 20 years and had dozens, hundreds of victims before anything was, action was actually taken.
And often lots
So,
of witnesses who either ignored
sure.
it and did nothing, or who thought, well, it must not
Or
have been
had
what
their
it seemed like,
suspicions.
or who
Yep.
deliberately covered up.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and many hospitals do that. We know this, like that's one of the things that I do. I help people report instances of abuse in obstetrics, and one of the things we know is like the first thing that most people do or think of when they think like, oh, I want to make a complaint or I want to report this to someone, is they go directly to the hospital where the act took place. And whew, y'all, like if you think that hospitals are like waiting to hold your hand and go take accountability for this stuff and make sure it never happens again, like do you have another thing coming? That literally does not happen. It doesn't happen. And in all of these lawsuits that you look at, the hospital, I mean, there were all kinds of reports made, and the hospital deliberately, made a choice. Somehow this dude's still working there 10, 15, 20 years later. I'm thinking of, in fact, like a colleague I work with really closely now who I met through my work. She was actually more of like a client than a colleague back then. I don't know, maybe 2017, 2018. She contacted me because she was a nurse, and she had witnessed a doctor commit a physical, like a pretty violent physical assault on a birthing person, a woman. And when she went to report it, she got in trouble. The first thing they said was her manager, whoever it was, the person above her, the person above her, said, when you write that report before you submit it, we need you to edit it. You can't call that, you can't use the word assault. You're not qualified to make that call. You can't call that by that name. Only a doctor would be able to determine if that was what we would call an assault. So that was a nurse who firsthand witnessed what happened and put her name on a report. Like, what more can you ask of people? Like, that's, she did what she was supposed to do. And she was, told, don't use that language. And then she was, essentially let go after that. And they, they kind of came after her even after that with like punitive measures. So that's the kind of stuff that's normal. Like, that's what I see as like a normal response.
That's just so disheartening, though. But I think it's really important for people to know that for every public allegation you hear about, there are tens of thousands you have not heard about. And for every woman who tells you a horrifying story, there are many
Well,
more,
for sure. Yeah,
perhaps the majority of women you know, like
I
who have
mean,
not told you.
yeah, and like that woman, that nurse, it was 3 or 4 years later, she got a message from another nurse, at that facility saying he's still doing it.
Is.
I mean, of course he is. Why wouldn't he?
So, okay. So, for my, I think this is my last question for you. One of the most important things that you do is you just educate women, and this is kind of limited to American women, at least in terms of the law, about their birthing rights and their right to say no. So, you have the chance to tell women what they should know going into birth. What do you want them to know?
Well, there's not a silver bullet. Like, I could say you have an absolute right to say no. But unfortunately, it's a lot more complicated than that. I think you should utilize that right, but you also have to like understand the potential repercussions of doing that. I wish like. If I could genuinely, like honestly say what I wish women would do, I wish they would boycott the system. I wish that they would and were able to and had access to midwifery care or an alternative to what is really a profit-driven, paternalistic obstetrics, system in the US. It's such a tricky thing to navigate. It's like, know your rights, get educated on your rights, hire a doula, make an advocacy plan with your doula, have an additional support person or two who are also trained on your rights, who go in with information and with their, the handouts that show like, actually, these are the guidelines and this is what the law says and, all this stuff. And it's so much, it's so much for so little guarantee of anything. There is no guarantee. I truly believe that it's a system that it only responds to financial incentives. And leaving that system en masse is like my dream. for American women. And I know that that's also not very realistic because the alternatives are so restricted. So I'm sorry I don't have like a nice, neat answer for you.
I think it's good that the answer is not nice and neat because the other bit of this is that the fact that we ever have to talk about self-advocacy and self-defense and all of that in a system that is ostensibly supposed to keep us healthy speaks to what is broken in the system. Because if the system were decent, you would not have to have any particular skills to enter the system and survive.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think,
Yeah.
I will say, just because I have to, Kristen has a ton of amazing materials that are really helpful and that are a lot more than just like, oh well, because there are things that you can do, but the fact remains that it's not the victim's fault, and you can do everything right and know everything and choose the right care provider and all that stuff, and you can still end up being assaulted or traumatized or mistreated when you are giving birth, because we live in a patriarchy, and that's what patriarchy does to women.
Yeah. All the things I have to tell people about how to navigate it, it's like, imagine like a war zone, you know? And I'm like, there's this one foxhole, you guys. If you can get this equipment and you can get this, you know, if you can get this protective equipment and you can get this one weapon and you can make it to that one foxhole, you might be okay.
God, that is what it's like, isn't it? That's just, it's
Yeah,
really.
and I hate that. I mean, I hate that. I hate that, you know, I don't have like a super positive, like, you know, do the things on this list.
Well, and let me say this, if you're like a medical provider listening to this and you're feeling defensive, we talked earlier about how that defensiveness you should sit with, and that's a problem. But I would also point out, like, okay, so if you are one of the good guys, then you have to believe that statistically you are an anomaly and that your patients have mostly encountered the bad guys. So rather than getting defensive of yourself, think about all that your patients have been through and all that you have not seen, but maybe should have seen.
And I'll add to that. There's a lot going on in the nurse world as far as really leaning into and fully owning the advocate role. It is still, you know, a fringe-ish movement, but it's very real and it's very much happening. I don't see that in the physician world. I am not aware, you know, of this like a similar push to aggregate the good guys and educate each other and educate your peers and go to conferences and speak about these things, and you know, show up and write papers talking about obstetric violence and how we need to, you know, stop committing obstetric violence and what we can do instead. I mean, you know, you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to speak up. You're allowed to organize. You're allowed to do all of that. Go for it.
Yeah, be someone who slows the abuse and who speaks out, because when you, what matters most in our lives is what we do with power. And so when you are the person who has the most power in a system, you have the highest obligation to protect your fellow human.
Yeah, and okay, you just made me think of something. I remember, so one of my colleagues is a black woman from Georgia. Like one of my close colleagues' favorite people who I talk to a lot. And I remember one time saying to her, like, God, I just feel so helpless, like, you know, there's just so much work to be done and it just feels so daunting and, you know, et cetera. And I expected her to like commiserate with me. And what she actually said to me was, if you feel helpless, think how we feel. And I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
As a white woman, you have exponentially more power than I have as a black woman. And yet, I am organizing with my peers, teaching people about advocacy, educating birth workers, leading a movement. If I can do this, what more could you be doing? I don't want to hear that you feel helpless. So again, we're back to like perspective. Yeah, I am in a position like, in the position I'm in. Yeah, it does feel daunting and it does feel all of these things. But also, I actually have my position of power is not such that I am at the bottom of the barrel, you know? And we've seen over and over again that black women keep making things happen despite the way that they are viewed and the way that they are treated and the way that they are marginalized. So I think a lot of it is like it kind of lives in our heads as far as our helplessness. And I hope that providers can hear that and find some hope in it actually. Like I'm telling you from my position, you have a shit ton more power than I do. And look at what I've done.
I
What
love
could you
that.
do?
I love that. And I think that's a great note to leave this on. Kristen, thank you so much, not only for being here, but also for just being you and for the incredible work you do and have done. We are all better because you are in the world. I will put all of Kristen's information in the show notes. Kristen, any parting words?
Thank you. No, I was just going to say kind of like right back at you. And it always like tickles me whenever I'm just like out in the world and I see something of yours like pop up on my social media or something, not from you, but that some random stranger in the world is like, putting some Zahn stuff out. It just like cracks me up. I'm like, oh, look at
Oh my God. So
that.
I'll see it. I see it all the time for you too, where someone will be like, oh, I just discovered this like woman birth activist and she's not a lawyer, but she seems like a lawyer. And she's like really intense, but also really charming. And I'm like, I know it's Kristen. I know it's Kristen. And then they'll like get to the end and they'll be like, her name is Kristen, like Pasca Ketty. I'm like, yeah, it's Kristen. All right. So that's it
Awesome.
for this one.